Some Christian churches, they speak about being grateful. I woke this morning clothed in my right mind. And so we sing, If It Be Your Will.
If it be your will that I speak no more, that my voice be still as it was before, I shall speak no more, I shall abide until I am spoken for, if it be your will, if it be your will, that a voice be true from this broken hill, I will sing to you from this broken hill, all your praises they shall ring. Your will to let me
the topic of learning from the animals around us to some degree. The topic we selected for today was the chrysalis, which is the one of the phases the caterpillar goes through when it's in its little cocoon, it's in its shell. And I think that not only is that phase an important phase, but every phase is important. And I think about my own life, how I spent many years studying, as many of us have, and then we get a job and we actually practice what we studied. And so it's kind of like we spend a lot of time in our dorm room studying and studying and studying, and then we come out into the world. And at some point, at least I decided, okay, there's got to be more to this. But in order for me to grow more, I need to go back into my shell and study some more. For me, one of the steps in my process was to completely leave the corporate world in which I lived and was extremely successful in by societal definition of what success was. I had this great condo and I had a sports car and I had the designer furniture and the designer clothes, and it looked really good on my social resume, if you would. And I decided there is potential for more growth, not necessarily corporate growth, like climbing up the corporate ladder, but individual growth. And in order to do that, I need to first break free of the cell I was in. In this case, it was the shape of a cubicle. So what drove me was the intention to lead a simple and uncomplicated life. And in many ways, you know, the saying, if you find yourself in a hole, the first thing to do is stop digging. So if I wanted an uncomplicated life, the first step is, many people go, well, I'm going to add yoga to it. I'm going to add meditation to it. I'm going to take Pilates. I'm going to just add more to an uncomplicated life in an attempt to make it uncomplicated. And my method was, before I'm going to add like more stuff to my uncomplicated life, why don't I use the process of elimination? If I want to go from complicated to uncomplicated, first thing to do is to remove the things that complicate it. For me, that looked like giving up the corporate world, giving up the condo that I was so attached to, the furniture, the designer clothes, getting rid of all of it, shedding that really comfortable shell, and being really vulnerable and raw and just throwing myself out into the world. In my case, it was to Hawaii, not a tough choice. But I moved there with no idea where I was gonna work, where I was gonna live, what my life was gonna be like. But my intention was like, I just want to leave a simple and uncomplicated life. And so I removed the complications, which was the job, which was the stress, which was the billable hours, which was relationships and dating and all this stuff. And I just left it all. And I'm like, I'm just gonna play volleyball every day. And that was fun for a while. And then I realized, you know, what else could I be doing with my time? I was playing volleyball 5 to 6 hours every day, which is great. And I didn't know what else I would be doing with my time had I not stopped playing volleyball. It's kind of like many times throughout our lives we say, well, I'm going to make a change when I know what's going to come next. Like, I'm going to take that step when I know what comes after it. And we want to see the entire road ahead of us. But I realized I'm not going to know what the next step is until I take the first one. And then the next step will reveal itself. So I decided, I remember calling my dad. And I grew up watching my dad play volleyball. So it was really cool that I started playing volleyball. And then he came to Hawaii and watched me play. He actually joined in a couple of games. And then I told him, I said, you know, I'm really glad you were here for this, because from this point forward, I want to give up volleyball. And he said, what? Why? You gave up the corporate life. You gave up this. You gave up all this. Why this? What harm is there in volleyball? And I said, it's not that there's harm in volleyball, but there could be potential benefit from giving it up. And I won't know what that benefit is until I do, if that makes any sense. So it's kind of like when I tell people, you know, get rid of all the extra stuff in your house, the extra towels, the extra bottles of shampoo, the extra dishes. And they go, what's the harm in having a full china cabinet full of dishes we never use? And I said, well, there's no harm in having that, but there's benefit from exercising that muscle of letting it go. Because then it becomes easier to let go of other stuff. So in this intention to make my life less complicated, I gave up volleyball. And what took its place was a lot of reading, a lot of soul searching. I met a local Tibetan Lama and I started studying in the Tibetan temple, and I just went inward and inward and inward, and I just started, like, at first I was reading, so I'm comparing it to kind of like the caterpillar phase when he's just eating a ton. I don't know if you've ever raised like monarchs, I know some of you do, and just eating so much. It's amazing how much green they go through. And that's what it felt like. I was studying anything and everything I could get my hands on. I would study with the local rabbi and the local Tibetan Lama, and I would go to church and I would just consume all of this information. And then, some of you know, I went up to the Lama, and much like the lobster who talked to the creator, I said, you know, with all due respect, I love the Tibetan teachings, but I don't think the Buddha intended for his teachings to get this complicated. Like, I want a simple life, and you've got multiple arms going on, and you've got this visual stimuli and the faces of all the different evils, and there is the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the Five Hindrances. There's just so many numbers, and it was so complicated. And, you know, many times people tell me that they've tried meditating, and they're like, well, I can't do it. I'm doing it wrong. And the only reason you feel like you're doing it wrong is because someone at some point told you there's a right way to do it. And I've read those books where you have to sit a certain way, and you have to have your eyes at a 45-degree angle, and then you got to breathe in from one nostril and out the other. I've read those books, and it's not a surprise that many people forget this. I'm just not going to do it. So I consumed as much as I could, and then I said, you know, the Buddha, if I want to stay true to the Buddha's teachings, I said, this isn't it. And I'm really grateful that instead of doing what many of the sects with whom I had met tried to do, which is to convert me, you know, take refuge with us, be one of us, he didn't say that. He said, you know, the Buddha didn't do this. The Tibetan culture did. This is their way. Why don't you try Zen? I think you would like that a lot more. So I left the Tibetan temple and I moved into a Zen monastery, which was significantly simpler, but it definitely felt like the caterpillar going into that cocoon, because we would do 4 to 8 hour sits every day. So just like sitting, staring at a blank wall for 8 hours a day. Some of you are going, I don't know how you do that. But keep in mind, I used to sit in a cubicle for 8 hours a day. So this is... I went kayaking the other day for 5 hours. My friend's like, I can't believe you did that for 5 hours. I'm like, dude, you work 10 hours a day. Like, how does kayaking? It's interesting. Anyway, so that very much felt like going into the cocoon. And in the Zen monastery, what's beautiful about that blank wall is after so many hours, that wall becomes a mirror. And it reflects back to you the very parts of you that throughout our lives, we try not to look at. In fact, we look for distractions to distract us from looking at our own problems. When you really think about it, the reason you point out everybody else's problems is because you don't want to deal with your own, right? It's so easy to go, you know what your problem is, but it's really hard to look within and go, I'm creating my own suffering. How am I doing that? So it felt very good to be in that cocoon. It was very comfortable. It's like I was in my comfortable shell, life was good. I was completely off the grid. There was no internet. There was no electricity. It was blissful. Keep in mind that a couple of years prior to that, I took the monastic vows to be of service to others. And for years, I had been sending letters to my friends to let them know what's going on with me, and to share with them everything I was learning when I was studying, when I was talking to everyone. But once I went into the monastery, those letters stopped. I stopped sharing with the world what I was learning. I just found my own little comfortable cocoon and said, peace out. I'm just going to stay right here. And a friend of mine, bless her heart, sent me a letter and said, Timber, I know you like it there. I get it. But how are you being of service if you tucked yourself in the mountain somewhere in the middle of nowhere? And I don't regret going, but getting that letter from her, I couldn't justify staying. That makes sense. Like I said, all right, this served its purpose. You know, and I may come back here from time to time and go into my little seclusion, but I can't spread what I'm learning if I'm keeping my wings wrapped up around me, if that makes sense. So I wanted to leave the monastery, but I didn't want to go right back into the cubicle. And I had learned about the middle path by this point, so I left the monastery and I moved into a temple with Wi-Fi. That was my middle path. And from that Wi-Fi accessible temple, we still had the morning meditations, we still had the 4 and 8 hour sits, we still had all that, but in between that, I had created a platform from which to share what I had learned. And what's nice is that this isn't my message, this isn't my wisdom. People say, oh, thank you for your wisdom. I'm like, this ain't mine, this is ancient stuff. I'm just like translating it into a language that we today can understand. And so that's when I started sharing those letters that I had sent to my friends over the course of many years. I started making them public. So in the sense of the chrysalis, in the sense of going into our own shell, it's not selfish to take care of this. If your intention is to take care of this, so then you can take care of others. So there's a distinction that like the intention is what's important. So if you're taking, the Buddha was asked, you know, there was so much to do, and he's like, how can you be taking a nap when so many people need your help? And he said, well, I can't help anyone if I don't get my nap. So even his nap was a selfless act, because the intention was to take care of this so he can take care of others. And I think there's a difference between saying, peace out, I'm out of here, I'm going to go into the monastery and just take care of me, you guys, good luck. Or to say, I'm going to go in and learn what I need to learn about this, because this is no different than this. Alanis once said that we're all battling similar demons, not coincidentally. It's not a coincidence that we're all challenged by the same things. I think, as in the story of the lobster, the creator would have said, I design things that way. It's so we can help one another, you know, because we're all dealing with the same stuff. It just shows itself in different ways. So the chrysalis phase, the going within, the spending so many years reading and consuming and studying and going to church and going to temple and going to a Buddhist monastery and reading online and meeting different gurus from different paths, that's great, just like the caterpillar is chewing and chewing and chewing. But at some point, we've got to come in and let it marinate or maybe ferment or whatever process needs to go through internally, so that then we can spread our wings and fly. Because otherwise we can fly, but we're flying within the little confines of our echo chamber. And that's not true freedom. That's comfort zone. Last week we had a discussion about the importance of stepping outside our comfort zone. I remember it was Deepak Chopra who said, don't think outside the box. Get rid of the box. And when we talked about the comfort zone, Michael Singer in The Untethered Soul was talking about how when we used to want to keep a dog in the yard, we would build an actual fence, and that would be the boundaries, and the dog would know, I need to stay within these boundaries. But ever since then, things have changed. Everything is electronic now, so you bury this wire under the ground, you put a little collar on the dog, and he gets a little vibration every time he gets close, right? It doesn't hurt him, it just feels uncomfortable. And the dog knows, oh, this is the end. These are my boundaries. And I think if we just spend our entire lives getting close to that zone of discomfort and then immediately retreat back and stay in our little space, then our world becomes really small. What Michael Singer said is, much like that dog, go to that point where your collar starts vibrating, where you start feeling uncomfortable and insecure and unsure of yourself, and stay there. Just stay there a little longer until you become comfortable with the discomfort. Is that just a little bit? And then a little bit longer the next day, and a little bit, until you're right there, until you can run right past. My parents, when I was a little kid, I used to bite my nails. So many of you probably know that I don't want to say nail polish, it's a thing they put, it's clear, and it tastes bitter. Some of you are nodding, going, yeah, mine too. It tastes bitter, so when you put your fingers in your mouth, it's bitter, and you stop biting your nails. Well, it doesn't work, because at first you're like, oh, I don't want to do that. You get used to it. We can get used to a lot of uncomfortable things. I went to college at Stanislaus State, where there are more cows than people. You get used to that smell. It's amazing what we can get used to, but if we spend our entire lives avoiding the discomfort of sitting for 8 hours, of staring at a wall, of keeping ourselves in that chrysalis and just wanting to break free, we make our world a lot smaller than it is. So I say find the edges of your comfort zone and stay there for a little bit, then take another step the next day until that wall, that imaginary wall, disappears. Because the only place it exists is in your own head. Right? It doesn't mean the wall didn't serve a purpose. At first, it was very important. You need to keep yourself confined, but everything is temporary. I'm going to finish with explaining how I went from that to this. So, in the monastery, we were all in monastic robes, we all had the same haircut, we all looked exactly the same way, because it was very much in line with the teachings that we're all the same, we're all one. So when you're walking up to the meditation hall and you see someone in front of you, you literally have no idea who it is, because from the back, we all look the same. Now, when I decided to leave the monastery and go back into that middle ground, I kept the monastic robes. I was still wearing that shell, which made sense in the monastery, but it didn't make sense outside. In the monastery, the robe said, look at me, I'm just like everybody else. Outside the monastery, it said, look at me, I'm different. Do you see that? And people started treating me differently, which was the exact opposite of what I was hoping. Like, here I am saying, we're all the same. And at the same time saying, look at me, I'm so different. I knew the day that the robes needed to come off when I took the bus and an old lady offered me her seat. And I said, thank you. And I went home and I took off the robes and I just got a pair of jeans and a t-shirt. So now when I go anywhere and I talk, and the book is required reading in a few high schools, it's in all the prisons across the country, and I go in, I give a talk immediately. I remember it was actually here at Rio Mesa High School, or maybe it was Camarillo High, one of the two. I gave a talk in front of a couple hundred students, and when it was over, I heard one of the students go up to his teacher, and he said, he's just like us. And that was exactly the point. So when we look at one another, we have this word, you know, namaste. That means, you know, the divinity in me sees the divinity in you. And that's wonderful and that's beautiful. But there's a whole other side to us. There's ego within each of us too. When we do something greedy, when we do something selfish, when we do something that causes harm to someone else because it gives us pleasure, that doesn't come from the God within, that comes from the ego within. But we don't have a word for that. We don't have the ego in me sees the ego in you. But I think we need one, and I'm still working on coming up with one. But until then, the God within me and the ego within you, they see each other, and they kind of give each other a wink and goes, I see you. I get it. Thank you.